You're listening to FMGRadio.com. Welcome to Generation Reinvention, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Future, with your host, Brent Green.
Welcome back. The future of travel is intrinsically connected to the boomer generation. This is not to suggest that boomers are the only cohort of value to the travel industry, but they will significantly shape travel products of the future. This is because of their relative wealth, their long-standing propensities to travel, increasing time in retirement, and their fundamental later life yearnings to learn about the wider world. Although both boomer men and women will be heading out on the highway or hopping the pond to Europe and unknown points, boomer women constitute the most significant opportunity segment of this generation for the travel industry. My guest this time is Kathy Dragon, who has more than two decades of experience in the adventure and experiential travel industry, including designing, marketing, selling, guiding, and operating small group travel tours worldwide for active adults. Kathy started leading bike tours back in 1987, and she's trained hundreds of guides and tour operators on the nuances of understanding the North American primetime traveler. That's adults 50 to 70 years old. And you may recall that several weeks ago, we interviewed Marty Barletta, who talked about the primetime woman. The impact of this group is substantial, and their needs and interests are unique within the global travel community, as Kathy will help us understand. So from Patagonia to Provence, Kilimanjaro to Komodo, Kathy has been there and personally escorted over 3,000 guests, primarily boomers and primarily women, on life-changing adventures. She's also developed a travel planning and promotional website for boomers called Travel Dragon. So I'd like to welcome Kathy Dragon to the show. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Brent.
It's great to have you a part of the program and our chance to finally sit down and talk a little bit about all the adventures. But I'm curious, because I've known you for a while now, and I've never really understood what lured you into this passionate lifestyle, adventure travel. What got you involved in the first place?
It definitely wasn't in my plans. I did a normal degree and was in sports science. But I think from a very early age, I was sort of surrounded by travel. My father was a navigator in the Air Force. And during the week, he was the CEO of the bank. And then he flew on the weekends to Korea and Greenland and all these different places. And when he would come back, he would put a pin in a globe that we had in our living room. And so we had pins from all the places that he had flown throughout his life, and also where my mother had traveled. And so it just kind of put places in front of me. And my grandmother was a big traveler. She had lost her husband early, and she had traveled with her friends to Peru and Argentina and all of these places, you know, many, many, many years ago. And she would have the things that she brought back from these destinations. So I would always ask her about them. So I think that's kind of got it into my blood.
So you had those early experiences, that also you had significant people around you that were encouraging you to consider how powerful and positive travel really can be. Well, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that you've learned on all of these travel experiences and some of the insights that you've garnered in this very robust movement around the world.
I guess there's so many big lessons that I've learned. I think it's more important than ever to travel. It changes the way we see things, and it changes how we interact with people when we return, how we listen to the news, how we vote, how we invest our money. Travel just, it changes our perception. I also think that it's so important to disconnect, to turn down the noise, to experience diversity, which, as you know, we don't have a lot of in Colorado and Vermont and places I've lived, and to just experience beauty and culture, and to preserve how things are done differently, how people eat differently and enjoy coffee differently and whatever it might be, and kind of to change our lens. That's really important for me, to just kind of get out of our own way. and to be kind of turned a little bit on our side. For example, a few years ago, I went to Jordan, and I never had that much interest in traveling to the Middle East. I was a little apprehensive about it. And so when the opportunity came up, I knew that I needed to go there because I wanted to experience for myself what it was like. And I just fell in love with Jordan. And, you know, seeing the things that you've read about or what you've heard about in the Bible or, you know, whatever, you're seeing living history. And it just had such an impact on me that when I returned, I had a completely different way that I read about what was happening in the Middle East and that I shopped or listened to the news or whatever it might be. So I think for me, that's one of the big lessons that I've had.
So it's becoming more self-aware, and it sounds like more self-aware in a very profound way.
Yes, for sure. I did an interesting program a while ago through the Gestalt University. It was an international organizational development program, and we spent 5 weeks over 15 months with about 35 people from around the world. And I think that word awareness is so important because if you're really in a destination and you're with people from around the world that are different from you, if you can slow down enough to just really be aware of what you're feeling and what your, you know, what your environment is telling you, I think that's a pretty fundamentally life-changing experience.
You know, one of the things that I have to watch in myself is that I love to pack and get organized and have everything I could possibly need, but nothing more than I could possibly need. And sometimes I've asked myself, am I creating kind of a packing tent around myself? In other words, I'm packing my psychological home with me so that I'm kind of insulating myself a little bit. Is that kind of what you're addressing here?
I'm not sure. I think that the idea of, you know, taking away the actual physical packing, but the idea that we like to surround ourselves with things that we're comfortable with, I think it's a really important issue. I think oftentimes we actually like to travel to places that we feel comfortable with. I think that how the people I've traveled with, oftentimes I travel with people over many years, decades. And the first place they might travel with me to might be Switzerland, which obviously is a pretty comfortable place to travel to. And I think as they progress in their travel, you know, portfolio, they become more confident and they're willing to I'd say, you know, change that comfort zone a little bit. So for example, I traveled with some folks in Switzerland, and the next time we traveled was to Greece in the Peloponnese. Very different experience, very remote. The next time we traveled was to Nepal. Again, completely different and more challenging experience. And then the next time was to India. So when you look at that progression, I think that that's a great example of sort of pushing beyond your boundaries in order to have a different and life-changing experience.
Yes, and I understand that in my own personal reflections, because when my wife and I decided that we would, you know, go beyond the boundaries of the U.S. and Mexico and Canada, the first place we selected was Great Britain for that exact reason, because, you know, we were somewhat intimidated by how weird would it be to be in a foreign country having never done it. And actually, the statistics bear out the fact that a remarkably large percentage of Americans never travel overseas. I mean, I don't know what the exact numbers are anymore, but it was like, you know, 20% of American citizens actually have traveled overseas. I don't know if that's right, but it was something in that vicinity.
And do you happen to know? I don't know. I saw the statistics a while ago around passports, and it's, you know, unfortunately incredibly low. I think one of the issues is, you know, the language, obviously. That, and I think, you know, taking it back to kind of our conversation around boomers, in general, this kind of group that we're both fairly passionate about, they don't like to, we don't like to feel that we're doing something wrong. We really like to be kind of appropriate. And we've spent most of our life making sure that we're, you know, saying and doing the right things. And so I think the language barriers really concern people. They want to be able to embrace traveling to Italy. And oftentimes they'll take a small language class before to make sure they know the basic words. And but then oftentimes when they're there, they're intimidated to actually use that language lesson because they don't want to say something wrong. So when we travel, I really try to encourage guests to learn a few words every single day and to use those. Because in general, that's a great way to interact with local people. And generally, they are encouraging of and appreciative of you trying to, you know, to use the language. On a negative side, I think that it's really unfortunate what's happening and how difficult it is to travel through airports now. And I think that's creating a challenge, especially for a lot of boomers and primetime travelers, because it's more and more difficult and frustrating to travel through these airports, and people are rushed and flights are canceled and, you know, taking off their shoes and things like that, that just add another level of barrier. So I hope that, you know, we'll be able to address that and make it more comfortable. I think that will be the future to, you know, how do we make it more comfortable for people to go beyond the borders?
Interesting. You kind of touched upon this just in a couple of things you said, Kathy, but what are some of the most important rewards of having a tour company? I think we can assume some of them, but what are the rewards to you for having a tour company as you do?
Well, possibly changing the wording of that. I think one of the things I have discussions with people all the time around is what the importance of traveling with a tour company is, or what we call tour operators. And my sister and I used to have this conversation because she's, you know, does a lot of independent travel. And she was saying, well, how, you know, these people, obviously the trips are more expensive and, you know, why would people do these trips? And I said to her, you know, when you're either in your lifestyle or at a certain age, you have all this time to basically be able to, you know, go to Southeast Asia and travel for 2 months or backpack around Europe or whatever it might be. That's a luxury. And that's a luxury both on someone that has that much time, someone that has the physical ability to do that. And there's some things that you can miss by doing that on your own is you tend to surround yourselves with people that are reading the same travel guidebooks like Lonely Planet or Fodor's, which, you know, great publications, but you stay in the same properties that everyone like you stays at, and you eat at the same restaurants that everyone like you eats at. So you're sort of taking that same group of people around the world. When you travel with a company, a good small, what I encourage kind of a small tour operator, they're able to really give you this experience that you're basically seeing the world as if you were invited to someone's home that you knew in that country, so that you're able to go to see the things that tourists don't see, to walk on the trails that local people walk on, to, you know, step into a house and have lunch because the guide knows the people in the farmhouse. So that kind of both planned and spontaneous adventure that happens and interactions that happen are so different from what you can read in the guidebook and what you can do on your own. For me personally, I think, you know, that's why I firmly believe and love to help small tour operators find the right clients, whether they're interested in culinary travel or historical travel or family or intergenerational, that people specialize in both destinations and kind of interest or activities. And these companies, that's all they do. So for me, it's, you know, it's been rewarding. I've had my own company called The Dragon's Path, which I still just do a couple of custom trips a year to keep my feet on the ground. Since 1998. And it's rewarding because I guess people come back because it's me and I go on all my own tours. Not necessarily a good business model, but it's something I really believe in. And then we always have local guides.
Okay. Well, you know, we're going to take a short break here. And then when we come back, I want to talk about green, eco, responsible, sustainable travel, which is basically one of the areas that you emphasize. So I want to thank our listeners for joining our discussion on Generation Reinvention. and helping explore with us how this generation is changing today and tomorrow. My guest is Kathy Dragon, adventurer, traveler, leader of women seeking reinvention, social media expert, and entrepreneur. And when we come back, we're going to touch on all of these areas.
You're listening to the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is have fun, make money, do good. We provide platforms to individuals who have a cause, message, or information that they would like to share with the world. If you'd like to join the FMG family and have your own radio show, please call us at 1-800-470-4982. That's 1-800-470-4982. We look forward to hearing from you.
My guest today is Kathy Dragon, and not only has she been a tour operator herself, and we will continue to explore what that means from her perspective, but she's also helped large organizations, including Whole Foods Markets and Eons.com, understand and incorporate travel into their offerings. She frequently consults and speaks to organizations interested in reaching the boomer and beyond consumer and understand how they interact with travel, social media, and healthy living. She has also been a consultant to Vermont Country Cyclers, Country Walkers, and then the Whole Foods product for travel, I believe, is Whole Journeys. So this is another busy person that we have on the show today. When we took the break, I was also interested to understand a little bit about what are some of the stresses of being a tour operator, particularly a small tour operator, Kathy?
I think the biggest stress is that you're dealing with people's lives and their trips of a lifetime. So you're dealing, for me, I have people that have traveled with me for, you know, over like 15 times on trips. And every time you're hoping to meet and exceed their expectations. And they have expectations around a certain destination they went to and a certain guide. So there's always that, you know, there's always that comparison that we all have. Oh, isn't this like Tuscany, or it's not as, you know, the hotel isn't quite as nice, or maybe we like the food here better or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a challenge. The biggest challenge probably for being a tour operator is liability insurance and being able to be responsible for things like weather and hazards that you really can't be responsible for. So I think the reason why people go on adventure travel programs is that they, you know, they want that in their lives. They want things that aren't predictable. But with that comes all the challenge of when things aren't predictable. So I think we all try to, are sort of type A perfectionists, that we try to create a platform for the tours that will allow that unexpected to come up, and that we hopefully have all the things in line when something goes wrong. But that's probably the biggest challenge. And the other is obviously filling your trips, you know, especially as a small company, being able to find the people that can go on those specific dates to those destinations that you hope to run tours to.
One of the areas that you talk about, you don't actually hyphenate it, but you bring these words together and your branding, if you will, of the travel type of experience you want to create and do create, and you call it green, eco, responsible, sustainable travel. What is that?
Well, that's the problem. There's no real word for this. It used to be called eco travel, and then people have tried responsible travel, geotourism, all sorts of different words that can mean different things and mean different things to different people. So what I speak more about is responsible travel and sustainable travel, which is, you know, is the type of trips that we're doing, are they sustainable? Are they sustainable for the company? Are they sustainable for the destinations that you're going to and the people that you're working with? If I do one trip a year to one destination and I'm the only person coming there, that guide probably won't make enough money from my trips. So kind of thinking of it from a lot of different ways. And I just, I've been on the board of Sustainable Travel International, STI, for years. And I wrote a blog post for them recently. And it was around sort of what this green, eco, responsible travel means to guests, to consumers. And are they willing to pay more for a company that is responsible? How do they determine what that company, what those company, the practices are. So I think it's very confusing because some companies say that, you know, we want to have a sustainably built eco lodge, and the building is really the focus. And other people say it's really important about the culture. We really want to help be sustainable in the local region and helping the local people that are there. Other people, it might be about the rainforest. So I think what's important for companies is to basically figure out what's important to them and be able to be very clear that all their energy goes into that commitment and letting their guests know what that is. So if it's around recycling or, you know, not giving pencils to the kids or whatever, that they've made that clear on their throughout their brand and on their website and can explain that. And then for consumers to figure out what's important to them when they travel. Is it offsetting their carbon footprint? Is it giving back to the local village? Is it employing local guides?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, I reflect upon my own, I guess you could say, historical experience with what you might call responsible travel, because I was a big adopter of backpacking in my young years. And, you know, I think the dictum for backpackers was take only pictures, leave only footprints. I believe that was the aphorism that people Yes. tended to use. And so, you know, it's kind of in the boomer mindset, which is a clever way for me to segue into talking more about boomers as travelers. Are boomers really any different than any older or younger generations in your judgment and experience?
They can be. They don't necessarily have to be. And I'm, you know, it's always challenging because whatever we say is, you know, there's such a wide wide range of what it looks like. I think that when I look at primetime travelers or kind of this specific age group, I think that a lot of the people that we know have been working very hard their entire life and they've waited to travel versus a generation today might get out of their MBA program and not have a job and travel or travel as a gap year. So in general, the boomer market didn't take those opportunities. And the boomer North American audience is very different from, let's say, the Australians who would take a year, or Europeans that are so close to so many different destinations that they travel for 2 months every summer and all over. So the boomer North American audience is very, very different. Time is a major issue that they have been waiting for a long time. And generally, they might go to a destination and not go back again. So each trip becomes sort of a trip of a lifetime. And they also have so many different interests that if you look at the top interests in boomers when they're retiring, or it's generally travel, volunteering, and learning, and spending time with friends and family, those four things. And what they really often are finding to do now when they're traveling is all of those things together, or more than one of those things. So if they're going, if their life dream is to go to Italy, they're actually interested in learning to cook in Italy or taking a language program in Italy, volunteering in Africa when they do their wildlife safari. So they're multitasking in some ways on their vacations. They also have issues really around, in some ways, comfort level. So when I took a group of 18 women to Nepal, I did it as an invite, and I sold the trip out in 2 weeks. I did personal handwritten invitations. And the women that went to Nepal with me, I knew that they had never been camping. And that if they were worried about going camping, their entire focus would be on that. So we stayed at comfortable, privately owned tea houses owned by the mayors of the village. And that allowed them to know that when they were hiking during the day, they could reach out and spend more time interacting with local people because they weren't worried that they would, you know, have not be able to take a shower in the evenings or even if it's a cold shower or not have a bed that they could sleep in. So there's definitely a comfort issue. And there's also, I think, there's an emergency issue, which is both medical as well as boomers are, you know, supporting and taking care of their elderly parents. So they want to be able to get out of a destination or have the ability to get phone calls if they need to. If something happens, they want to know that there's a good medical facility close by. So that's another, you know, issue. There's a number of sort of tag issues that you look at that do make Boomer North American travelers a little bit different.
Well, that's very interesting because I know that there was a big rush to travel in Europe in the late 60s. In fact, the statistic I found one time was that in 1969, 500,000 North Americans went over to Europe, which was a large number considering how much more inconvenient it was. So in a sense, I believe you're absolutely correct that buried in our mindset is this yearning to travel. There's some that went over to Europe and had those amazing experiences back in the 60s, and there's a lot more that didn't and wish they could have. And I know my own travel into Europe was somewhat to answer that dream that I had had when I was young but never took advantage of, partly because of the cost and partly because of got busy with life and got busy with career. So I'd be interested because this is something that has been always of curiosity to me about what you do. And I wondered if you could take us into one of your trips so that we can visualize how it works and affects your clients. And I think in our discussion, you mentioned Slovenia as a good example. Tell us a little bit about that trip.
Well, that was a very different trip. And that specifically, I do maybe 30% of my trips are women-only trips. And just to kind of segue into that, I think that there's certain reasons why women are traveling increasingly with other women. Oftentimes, I found that they prefer to take physically challenging and culturally challenging trips with other women. Even though they may love to travel with their husband or their, you know, other people, their partners, the physically challenging trips, they really like to be in a supportive environment. For example, taking women to on a harder hiking trip in Slovenia, but also camping on the Inca Trail, they wanted to do that with women so they could figure out kind of the whole idea of camping together. So in Slovenia, I had a group of women that had traveled with me and said, you know, Kathy, we want to go on a hiking trip and we like to drink wine and hike, but we don't want to spend a lot of money. We think we want to go to Switzerland. And I said, no, you don't. Switzerland's wonderful, but it's not, you know, that inexpensive. And how about Slovenia, which is kind of the unknown, you know, very similar to Switzerland in many ways, and great hiking, wonderful wines, just not that well known. And so I had 18 women. They all sent their deposits, and they didn't really know where it was. And I think that's the idea of one, inviting people, which women often say, you know, after 45, we accept all invitations because they're, you know, they say they're, I don't want to not be invited, so I'm going to, you know, take on new things. But also that idea of just trusting someone that they think understands them, and that's also really important. But to take you through more of a traditional, kind of the trips that I do, which are generally cultural walking trips, because those are things I really love. Generally these group sizes are between 8 to 16 people. And generally, and if they're in Europe, they're about a week long, because that's kind of a time frame that people can do between, you know, two long weekends and extend if they want. And in Asia or South America, like in Patagonia or Indochina, they would be 2-week trips, again, with extensions, so to give people more time. And usually boomers also would prefer not to move every night. So we usually spend 2 to 3 nights at each property. And we try to have different types of properties. So generally, really appreciative of boutique properties, small privately owned, whether it's a small villa or a small city hotel, and kind of complementary properties. So in Tuscany, we might stay in a historic hill village of Montalcino, but we will also stay at a villa out in the countryside so people get an idea of different things. And generally, there's a physical activity with different options, so walking or biking or kayaking, things like that, but also lots of interaction like local visits, so cheese tasting and wine tastings, and in Patagonia, when we're in Argentina and Buenos Aires, we do a little tango class before we go out to a tango club. So I think it's all around the experience. And the other thing that we often do is we create modules. So if people have more time, like in Croatia this fall, I have a week on a boat, a small boat that's just for 12 people, and sailing along the coast and walking every day and local visits. And then we're doing an extension to Istria, which is where the truffle harvest and the wine harvest, so that anyone that can take that extra week is going to a completely different area in the same country, which is complementary.
Well, it sounds like a fantastic experience and very original and very rich with new opportunities for people. And so for our listeners' benefit, I will give you a couple of places that you can check out. And we're going to talk about another one when we come back. But you can find a lot of information about the types of tours that Kathy leads herself at traveldragon.com. And you also could take a look at activewomen.com. And then when we come back, we're going to talk more about her, I guess you could call it a tour portal for boomers called The Dragon's Path. And also I want to talk with Kathy some about her remarkable skills with social networking. So stick around. We will be right back.
Be sure to join us at fmguniversity.com. That's where we can turn your passion into business within 30 days. Put some fun back into your life, show you how to make money, and do good for yourself and others. That's why we are called FMG, Fun Money Good. Get started today. Go to fmguniversity.com.
We're talking with Kathy Dragon, who is very much a worldwide traveler and a leader of other people who would like to learn more about the wider world. And I misspoke when I led into the break, and that the travel portal is actually traveldragon.com, and that is where you will find tours provided by small tour operators and others from around the world. And now, Kathy, this would be a good opportunity for you to talk about what it is a little bit and what you have in mind, what your goals are.
Sure. I created Travel Dragon a few years ago with this idea that the Dragon's Path, which is my own company, walking tour company, is just one company. But there's so many great companies that provide different experiences around culinary travel or surf travel or kayaking or family. So I created basically a kayak-like search engine for the companies that I curate. I invited the companies to be on the site. So I have about 6,000 products and about 500 companies, and you can search through and filter by group size, exertion level, comfort level, commitment to sustainable travel, price, months offered, things like that. And also we have, you know, like National Geographic award winners and Travel and Leisure award winners, sort of other brands that have been designated, you know, great companies that you can find. And the whole thing was around transparency, that you could connect with these companies directly, because the big thing that I think we all know is, you know, the price points are higher on these trips, and they're very complicated itineraries. So most times people want to contact that company, you know, two or three times before they make a final decision on their African safari or, you know, their biking trip in Provence. So we say, you know, trips of a lifetime aren't found in a shopping cart. And that's sort of the theory of Travel Dragon.
I see. Well, it's definitely a rich resource. And I hope our listeners made note mentally that we're talking about 6,000 different options on one site. And then they have been curated by Kathy Dragon, who has enormous experience in understanding both the obvious and the not so obvious about what's going to make an outstanding travel experience. Now, another thing about Kathy that is very remarkable and noticeable is that she has built quite a reputation through the implementation of the so-called social networking platforms such as LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Flickr, and so forth. And I wanted to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about that, because many of our listeners are either in business and creating social networks for their organizations, or they're individuals who want to expand their networks so they can expand their lives, so to speak. So, Kathy, give us an insider's look at this. And I'm going to ask you by, you know, looking at each one of these, because they're all very different in terms of their implementation and purpose. Let's begin with Facebook, because you have a remarkable number of Facebook friends. It's well over 1,000. In fact, you probably know closely what it is.
I think, well, Facebook, as probably everyone, all your listeners know, is the fastest growing group on Facebook are boomer women. So I think it's obviously a natural place for any business interested in, you know, boomers to have their business there. Facebook is naturally, you know, it's easy for me because my friends, who are often the people I travel with, are there. So it's kind of that idea of, you know, go where your tribe is. I think, you know, it's a lot of companies try to create their own social network or try to hook onto a social network that might, you know, not be where their consumers are. So I think Facebook's been something that I really like seeing how it grows and also what the concerns are for boomers, because it's not very intuitive. The user interface isn't great for people. Oftentimes you'll see, you know, people help their moms get their, you know, I'll see kids helping their moms get their, get onto Facebook, but they don't have a photo because people don't know how to load a photo. It's not that easy. Security issues are obviously a huge controversy lately, or over the last couple of years of Facebook. And it's never easy for people, especially the boomers, to kind of dig into where the security features are and change those. And I think for me, the whole social media platform is really is looking at it as a platform. And that platform is a combination of, you know, your, as a business, it's, you know, your website and your blog, how you share news and ideas and research, and then how that feeds into Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn. So I think different ones have different, you know, sticking power for your business, but it needs to be set up correctly so it's easy to post across the portfolio.
Okay, now Facebook is what I think of as the friends place, and because we friend people in Facebook. Are all the people who are your friends on Facebook truly friends, or how do you separate, or how do you think about this from a business perspective versus a true friend perspective? Do you think about it?
So I think about it differently. I think everyone thinks about it differently. Some people, I have business pages for all of my different businesses. However, what sticks for me, I'm so busy. What sticks for me is being me personally on Facebook. And so even though possibly I should have a page called Kathy Dragon as a brand, that doesn't really work for me. So I sort of live more time than other places in my personal Facebook profile, and I'm very transparent there. So I do share social media links that I'm interested in, which some people could probably say, you know, why is she putting up this link that I don't care about, you know, Google Plus One or whatever it might be. But I also share photos while I'm traveling. I'm constantly posting photos. And I share, you know, challenges that I'm having with work. So, for me, you know, many of those people are work contacts. They're tour operators, they're writers. You know, I've met them throughout my life, and it's just easier for me to not compartmentalize things so much.
Okay. Well, I noticed that I just did a quick search, and you have 1,324 friends. That's a lot, in my judgment. I'm sure there are people out there that have more. But still, I think that's quite an accomplishment. And, you know, the tone of what you do, right, I've noticed is more toward the personal. You're not out there just pitching your businesses that aggressively or something like that. But you're sharing photos of where you've been. And that's what I always notice when I see something from Kathy Dragon on my wall. It's usually something that is about where you are and some really great photos. So I see it that way. How do you look at LinkedIn? How's LinkedIn different, and how are you using LinkedIn?
Actually, I'm really excited about LinkedIn over the last year. I think LinkedIn took a slower approach to being open to, you know, how they grew, to plugins, to, you know, third-party APIs. They thought about it longer, which is probably why it doesn't have the same volume, obviously, as Facebook. But I think they've done some really exciting new things. I think the integration that they've offered lately, I think the groups, you know, joining and contributing to groups is great. Now being able to integrate or not integrate your Twitter feeds and share links is wonderful. So for me, LinkedIn is, it really is a very important business place for me to be, because now when people say, well, if I'm applying for, you know, a job or a consulting role or something, and traditionally people would say, you know, can you send me a reference? And I can just export my references from LinkedIn. So I just think that's kind of, yeah. So I think there's just a lot of, and I got, I really kind of built, I think one thing to think about both with like Twitter or LinkedIn, is I'm pretty much an early adopter. I was an early adopter to LinkedIn. So I got a lot early, which is a lot easier than, you know, getting in there kind of later. I think it's a perfect example with businesses on Facebook. Early on, if you created a business page, you could easily get 700 people or whatever, you know, even if you're a small company, to be your friend on, you know, friend your page very quickly. Now it's much harder. There's just the noise volume is so high that people just are turning off newsletters or turning off Facebook pages. There's just too much noise.
Yes. Well, that is for sure. And this early adopter stature that you have, now I notice in LinkedIn, you have well over 500 LinkedIn network colleagues and clients and so forth. And have you found that that's been helpful in building your tour operations as well as your, you know, attention to the portal, your travel portal and so forth?
I think probably I don't live in LinkedIn as much as some people that are kind of trying to build up their brand do. I could probably live there more.
live there.
you know, that's kind of how people feel. Like they kind of live in either Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn. They sort of hang out there during the day. I'll go to LinkedIn, but I don't have a LinkedIn window open. So I think it's definitely helped for if I need something for Travel Dragon, like if I'm looking for, we didn't have as many great culinary programs as I wanted. So I put up something in one of the groups and had these great little companies apply. And I think more I'm sharing links to certain groups that I think would be relevant to them, you know. So and definitely for people being able to see that I have credibility and staying power, even though I'm doing a lot of different things, I think people could look at that and say, she's been in this industry, in this space for a long time, and she, you know, has references around that. I do get people that try to, I'd say, you know, it's basically my Rolodex is online now. I think it's over 5,000. I think it's much higher, that people kind of go into your Rolodex through LinkedIn and want to get introductions to the people that you know. So that can be a bit of a challenge.
Right. It seems to me that well over 5,000, my goodness, that would be daunting, particularly if people are reaching out to you. I don't have that happen to me very often where people say, will you introduce me to so-and-so, because I can see that they're in your list of contacts. But since you've operated in an industry that involves so many different kinds of interactions and people knowing people becomes a very valuable asset, I could see where that would happen in the travel industry. Well, to take our journey full circle, you also tweet, and I'm kind of wondering how you then integrate Twitter into your activities. Is that changing? Are you using Twitter differently from when you started, actually?
Yes. I think I go through, though I am an early adopter, I always have a lens both of boomers and travel, the travel industry. So I'm always interested in getting into things that I think might have potential in these different markets. I don't just jump into, you know, adopting anything. So for Twitter, I had a lot of followers early because, again, I was an early adopter to it. And I use a, you know, like Hootsuite or a third-party application to be able to share information across different platforms and across even different Twitter profiles. I think I have 4 Twitter profiles. However, I do think I go through this thing of, you know, what I have a crush on and what I'm in love with. So I think I had a crush on Twitter. I'm not really in love with it. It seems that the conversations, I like sharing links that I'm learning. I'm not really great at like reply to all, thanks, you know, kind of just this mutual conversation that's going between two people. Doesn't really work for me as much. Sometimes I tweet when I go to a specific event, like a food and wine festival, and I want to post photos and, you know, kind of be more engaged. At a conference, I'll be tweeting. But in general, it just doesn't fit my lifestyle that well. And I think that, or at least not right now. So I think we all have to kind of be realistic about what feels natural and where we kind of feel comfortable being. And I think Twitter is great for writers and getting PR and things like that. But I don't feel like a lot of the boomer friends I have or people that run companies are the ones that are tweeting.
I see. Well, I would be remiss in not asking, since you are an early adopter, what's on the early adoption list next? What do you think is the next big online social interaction opportunity?
I think there's so many things. You know, obviously, Google's this whole Groupon model, Groupon Living Social, group deals, that is obviously just taking off in the last year, and people haven't figured it out around travel. I mean, there's a lot of sites that are incorporating travel, but not the type of travel that I do. So I think there's still a ton of potential around that. Google is in beta now for new, you know, group buying. So that's one thing. Definitely the issue around mobile and tablets is really interesting to me, specifically of how people are using them when they're traveling. And I think there's a lot of potential still there. The other thing I think that hasn't really been tapped as far as the boomer market is content and a way for boomers to more easily share the content that they've built throughout their lives. So I think there's some exciting things going on in the future around that. But I do believe it's going to be more ways for people to filter through noise. Curation is going to be more and more important.
Right. Well, I might mention when you're saying content, I think what you're implying are, you know, like I've got boxes of slides going all back to the 70s, and they sit in boxes of slides, and I never look at them. Wouldn't it be great if I could go online and see those and share some of those, because I have some real gems from various historical periods, you know, from the disco days to the hippie days. That would be fun for people to look at, even if they are of, you know, my life. So, yeah, I think that's a big deal. Well, we're going to take a final break and come back and talk with Kathy, because we're always interested in getting ideas about the future. What is she thinking in terms of how boomer travel is changing and is going to continue to change? So stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is have fun, make money, do good. We provide platforms to individuals who have a cause, message, or information that they would like to share with the world. If you'd like to join the FMG family and have your own radio show, please call us at 1-800-470-4982. That's 1-800-470-4982. We look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you for joining us on Generation Reinvention today. And again, Kathy Dragon is my guest, and I do encourage you to take a look at her various websites. TheDragonsPath.com, TravelDragon.com, and ActiveWomen.com. And that will open up a world of possibilities to your future travel experiences. And I also would like to mention that Kathy and I actually met at an airport in Houston on our way to both be speakers for the National Ski Areas Association. We'd never met, And so we kind of met each other traveling and had an opportunity to get to know each other that way. And she is an expert on this area. So I encourage groups and organizations out there that want to bring in a knowledgeable individual who can talk about travel today, particularly for the boomer generation and into the future. This is the person. And speaking of the future, I'm interested, Kathy, how you see the growth of the market for boomer women traveling together or as singles in particular. What are you seeing? What are your tea leaves saying about that?
Well, boomer travel for women specifically will be growing. Women are outliving their husbands or partners, you know, by 5 to 8 years. They're inheriting from their parents and from their husbands. They are active and engaged longer and working out with trainers and, you know, and alone after the age of, you know, 50, many of them, and surrounding themselves with other positive, engaged, active women. So they are continuing to travel more and more so with other girlfriends. I'd say, you know, they're definitely a predominant traveler out in the world today, especially when destinations like, you know, the Southeast Asia and, right, you know, throughout India and Nepal. I mean, they're just going there. They just can't wait to take an Ayurvedic, you know, program in Kerala, India, and go to Bhutan and volunteer in Africa. They're just traveling everywhere and volunteering and doing all sorts of things. So they will continue to travel. Intergenerational travel is huge and will continue to grow. Grandparents, my guests that are in their 70s are taking their kids in their 40s and their grandkids, you know, in their teens on trips together. So that really changes. All of a sudden, you know, you have a group of 20 people or 10 people traveling together, and what the facilities are like, if there's activities for the grandkids so the adults can go to a Michelin-starred restaurant while the kids are making pizza in Tuscany, all of that is just evolving. Voluntourism for adults is something that's been on the radar for the last 5 years, but there's still so much to be addressed around the needs and the interests of the boomer traveler, that they're not the same people that are, you know, college and high school kids taking voluntourism trips. They're looking for something totally different and their needs are different. So there's a lot there that's still developing. Learning vacations only becoming more and more interesting for people. Small ship cruises and villa rentals are very exciting. We spoke about that a bit, but people not wanting to pack and unpack. And, you know, my Turkey trips and Croatia sailing and small ship trips in Alaska are, you know, a way for people to be able to, you know, kayak and hike and have a great speaker in the evenings, great food and wine, and not have to pack and unpack.
Wonderful.
Yes. And same thing with villa rentals, if people wanting to take a group of friends, you know, to rent a villa in Italy or Argentina.
Gosh, that'd be fun to do. Well, how do you feel the technologies are going to be changing? Because boomers are famous for adopting technologies. I mean, I filled a basement full of backpacking equipment and got every generation of portable stove you can imagine, from the old gasoline stoves to the high-tech Japanese propane stoves of today. So where do you see technology changing to support this motivation to get out there?
Well, there's two things, and I'm such a gear and gadget gal. I'm obsessed with things like that. So I think when I travel now with my guests, almost on every trip, we have people, I'll do a little private iPhone 101, something about how to post through your iPhone or how to change your security settings or how to, there's a lot of, boomers are buying this stuff and they're paying full price. They have their iPads and their Kindles and their iPhones and their top, you know, Nikon digital cameras. They're buying it all. But oftentimes no one's really trained them how to use it. So I think there's a lot of potential around kind of mobile posting, because they do want to share their experience both while they're there with their grandkids or with their kids and with their friends, but also when they get back, which is why kind of Apple's one-on-one classes are so great. They want to make a video for all their friends over Christmas of their experience in Tuscany, whatever it might be. So that's changing and has so much potential because it's not really intuitive. A lot of the new technology, specifically for boomers, gear and gadgets. So I'm obsessed, like, as I said, but with like travel clothing, that market has just changed completely since when I started, you know, doing trekking trips in Peru. Everything was tan and baggy, and it looked like men's clothing on women. So for now, you know, these people are going on a trip. Our guests are going on these trips with one suitcase generally. And that suitcase has everything that people are paying full price for. If they can only buy one piece, it needs to look great on them. It needs to fit them. They want to know how to wear their backpacks properly, you know, how to pack their suitcases properly. They want to be able to go hiking during the day and look great in their, and, you know, going out for wine in the evenings. So I think there's still a lot of potential in the retail space of understanding the boomer traveler.
That is interesting, and an area that I would love to talk with you a lot more about. Unfortunately, we're kind of winding down. I have one more question for you, and I kind of have to keep your answer somewhat crisp because we are pushing the end of our conversation today. But will there be relatively untouched places on this planet in another 20 years? Should we expect to find Starbucks and McDonald's just about everywhere we might go in the future?
I think there will be untouched places. I think people are thinking about tourism development differently now, and thinking about the protection and the quality of the projects that are being built there, and limiting the numbers of people and, you know, the types of travelers.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm encouraged by that because, you know, I remember how discouraged I got when I was standing in this beautiful square in Italy and looked over my shoulder and there was a McDonald's tucked away over in the corner. It just didn't work for me. But anyway, I want to thank you, Kathy, for joining us today and giving us a clear view of the opportunities that we have for travel. And also, you know, the ways in which we can really experience our lives differently. And I would encourage all of you who are listening to this program to visit Kathy's sites, including thedragonspath.com, traveldragon.com, and activewomen.com. Let's keep our journey and our travels going forward in discovering Generation Reinvention.
You've been listening to Generation Reinvention with your host, Brent Green. Visit Brent at his website at generationreinvention.com. And for archive shows, be sure to visit his show page here on the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is, have fun, make money.